backwards. It's a location where, from the satellites in orbit around Mars, three geological interesting features come together at one point. So they gave it a name. And that it'll spend like a couple of months there. That's the first real investigating area that they're going to go to. Because to create this, you probably had to have water. You've got drift on one side, you need wind. You've got all kinds of different geological stuff that's very interesting to the scientists. So it'll spend some time there. And I believe they said that was about 2.5 miles or so away from that landing site. And then to double that, so that would be when you get to Mount Sharp. So it's Mount Sharp, I think it's roughly 5 to 6 miles away, maybe 7 miles away from the landing site. And it's a straight line. Let me drop it. On a map, it looks like it's a straight line to this first location, Lenox. And then they'll probably change. It looks like maybe a 30-degree offset to get to the mountain itself. I guess they're kind of like going around to get to this one feature instead of going, you know, direct shot. They're not losing too much time. Plus, what's more important, they really want to find out what's at this one location. So they're not going in circle willy-nilly anywhere. And I give you an idea. I think the total distance of Spirit and Opportunity has been 17 miles. Let me drop it. I think I remember reading 17 miles. But one of them is like 8 or 9 miles, and the other one is 6 miles or something. Now, they landed in 2004. I think one was January 3rd, and the other one was 2 weeks later, probably on, I think it was the 14th of 2004, and here we are, you know, almost 10 years later, it's like 8 years later, and in this 8-year period, two battery-operated, solar-operated craft have managed to, you know, get somewhere, but I mean, you know, it's a slow crawl. Now, the same thing for Curiosity. It doesn't go any faster than these two do. So, the first 2-year mission, you could expect maybe 5 miles, 6 miles out of this thing. Then you're going to have extended missions after that, I'm sure. A total odometer, you know, maybe by the time this thing gives up the ghost, you know, I'm hoping they get about 20 miles out of it. Back to you, John.
Paul, to your knowledge, I know originally when it landed they had some rocks that caused issues with one of the arms. Has there been any failure of any items, or did anything not deploy? Is everything seemed to be working the way they planned? And I promise that's my last question. Back to you, Paul. KC2WGP, I'm Mark Techman.
I see everything worked. The camera system and radar system coming down through the atmosphere all worked great. After they landed, the Dan experiment worked great. That's the one that was built by the Russians to look under the ground and see if there's any moisture, you know, maybe 3-4 feet under the ground. All the cameras, had 17 cameras on board, 17 different cameras. And of course, they worked good. All the eyepieces dropped off, the protective eyepieces. And some of them come back on again, some of them just go off permanently. The cameras on board, the mast, they all work great. And the one that worked with the laser beam, excellent. I mean, that thing's been used a number of times already. Fires, I think, 30 blasts per second at one particular spot. It heats up the rock or whatever it is, the sand, and in between each of those 30-second blasts, you've got a camera that records all this information through the, and then it goes down to the spectrometer to tell what it's made out of. nothing worked right. The 10-minute experiment, I mentioned that before, that's in the body of the Curiosity. Some analysis of the soil worked great. And they just tested the FAM. That's another testing gadget inside the body of Curiosity, and nothing worked good. The only thing that failed was the weather station. Not 100%. It's built by Spain. Some of the rocks, whatever, hit it when it was landing, and they knocked out half of it, and the other half is still operating, and they're able to compensate for it. So they're still getting 100% readings. They didn't have more than the capabilities. They still get the temperature. They still get the wind. They're still getting the how much radiation is coming in from the sun and the cosmic rays. That's being picked up. So, I don't know. Out of all these 10 different experiments on board, they're all working. Back to you, John.
That's great information. It's good to hear that we can do something right. Apparently, NASA and these contractors they hire are doing a hell of a job. So I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more of this as it gets further toward its location. And that's where the real science is going to take place. Okay. If there's anybody out there that has a question for Paul on any of their space projects, please do so. This is KC2WGB, Limark TechNet.
Please, Uncle.
Bernie, go ahead.
Okay, I'm fascinated with this Voyager stuff. I mean, talk about DX, right? I mean, this is the absolute ultimate stretching of radio technology. So I have a few questions. For one thing, if you could say in miles how far that craft is in miles, that would be cool. Also, how much power is it transmitting? What frequency? What mode? How much gain does the antenna have? What does it sound like on the receiving end? I mean, the radio aspect of Voyager is just absolutely astounding. Back to net, I guess.
Okay, Bernie, let's see if Paul has any information on that. He gave the distance, so if you have any fill-in on that, Paul, please go ahead. KC2WGB, over you.
Okay, Bernie. Yeah, well, let's see. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, they took different paths. One is on the ecliptic. That's the... You have all the planets, and they're all running around basically the same angle off the relationship to the what's called the equator of the sun. So that's the ecliptic. Well, Voyager 1 took a different path. It kind of went off on an angle, and it's like 35, 40 degrees off the ecliptic going up. That's the one that's furthest away. And the reason for that it was they needed they were going to do this deal. I mean, they both craft went past Jupiter and then Saturn, and then they sent Voyager 2 on the way to Neptune and Uranus, and Pluto wasn't in line, so they couldn't pick that up. But they wanted very very much to look at the moon of Saturn called Titan, and the only way to do that was to change the trajectory, the whole angle of where Voyager 1 was going, and by doing that it was going to send it off, you know, what's called north of the ecliptic. So that's what happened, but by doing that one was like much further away than Voyager 2, let me drop it. You know, it did take its pictures of Titan, which really helped out, and years later they decided, well, this is a good idea. From the pictures we got of that, we better send a space probe, and they did. When Cassini went to Saturn, they sent the Huygens spacecraft attached to it, and separated from the mother craft, and from Cassini and Madonna, and actually landed on the moon of Titan. And that goes around that goes around Saturn. So that's the history of it. Distance-wise, well, we know that light travels 186,000 miles roughly a second per second, just one, every single second. So to get to where these spacecraft are at that speed, it's 17 hours. Now you can multiply it that way, and then the numbers really get out of hand. Or you could use the AU formulas. I like that, the astronomical units. Let me drop it. Give you an idea, one AU is 93 million miles between here and the sun. So if you go out to 1.6 AU, now you're out to Mars, you know. And then you get out to, you can keep going, I think Jupiter's 5 AU, and it goes on and on. When you get out to Pluto, you're out to 39 AU, 39 times the distance between the Sun and the Earth, and that's 93 million miles. So 93 million miles times 39, that gives you how many miles you got all the way out to Pluto. Now, of course, you might have, it might be 40 or it might be 38. You know, as the Earth goes around the Sun, sometimes we're closer to Pluto, but sometimes we're further away. We might be on the other side of the Sun. So if you're at the other side of the Sun, you're minus 2 AU, and if you're on the positive side of the Sun, nearest Jupiter now, you're plus 2 AU. Not much of a difference. Let's call the average 39 astronomical units. Drop it. Beginning when we first started talking about this, that W2ZEN Lewis sent the story in about the Voyager, the update anyway. I let him know that, of course, we do talk about Voyager quite a bit on the net, but this was a good update with this magnetic highway story. In the beginning of that, we talked about 4 AU, so that's 4 times the distance from, you know, from how far Pluto is away from the Sun. So that gives you that. And the power output, think of this traveling wave tube on board and all, and you know, 6-foot antenna point, I think it's 6 or 5 foot parallel beam or, you know, facing Earth. But, you know, you've got I don't know what the effective gain is. If Dick was on board, he'd be able to tell you the effective radiated power. But the power itself being put to that antenna is 20 watts, Bernie. Back to that, and then I guess back to Bernie, WS2X.
Very good, Paul. I believe Dick said that traveling wave tube is putting out approximately 10 watts now, but you're saying 20. You're the one reading the NASA report, so you probably know. Bernie, any other questions for Paul? PC2WGB, Limark Tickman.
As you can, real quick, this is great. I really appreciate it. And by the way, so roughly, you're talking about roughly 3.7 billion miles, I think, more or less, 3.7 billion miles. I mean, that's, every day is history being made for DX. I mean, this is unbelievable. For 20 watts, it's crazy. So yeah, the last thing is, what's the frequency and what's the mode? And thanks a lot. Appreciate all the information. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Pick it up. Let's see. Jupiter was half a billion. Saturn was a billion. No, I think it's roughly 3.5 or 4 billion miles just to get to Pluto. So now multiply that times 40. So you're looking at, you know, I guess 12 billion. No, maybe 16 billion miles. Wow. I know it's, I think they're talking about 168 AU from where it is now, 160, so And the other one, I think, is 120. Voyager 2 is, I think, I'm around 120 AU. So, no, I think it's roughly 4 billion miles to Pluto, as I remember. I don't know. I don't think of it as miles, but, you know, and that was a half a billion to Jupiter, a billion to Saturn, another 2 billion to Neptune. I think 3.5 billion miles, so let's call it 3 billion minimum. So times four, at least 12 billion miles, Bernie. And mode of operation, well, it's, I don't know, it's a digital pulse thing, I guess. Let me drop it. I believe the power is, yeah, 20 watts. I'm going by Ed Stone, John. He was with us from the beginning. He was a young guy when this all started, and he's still involved with this. I think he's retired, but he still does, he still gets involved with the Voyager project. And probably about 6 months ago or so, I saw him on being interviewed, and he did say it was still putting out 20 watts. So that's what I'm going by. He asked another question, I think, whatever it was. The mode. Yeah, I really don't know. I guess what it is. Pulse, John, is that what it is? You and John would know. You and Dick would know that better than me. What mode would you call that? I don't know. To me, it's all digital. Back to you there, John.
Paul, I believe it's pulse width modulated. I'm not sure. I'm sure Dick has monitored these things, so he would know for sure. And, miss him tonight. He's got to get better real quick. Okay, are there any other questions out there for Paul? It's KC2WGB. I'm Mark Pickman. Okay, Paul, thank you for that report. Great information. And I'll start studying up for next week. And let me let it drop before we go over to Wesley, or somebody maybe out there. I just have a little thing I want to mention. When I was listening to the InfoNet and some other times, I heard our president, Richie, K2KMD, mention the Limark Party. And I just wanted to remind people that the only requirement is to bring a new toy, value under $20, unwrapped, which will be accepted there. And that's going to a hospital, from what I understand, for the children, which is a wonderful thing. Just imagine being a child. And, you know, you have somebody paying attention, and maybe they'll alleviate some of the stress they have from their illnesses. I just think that's great what the Limark people and the board members have arranged, and I hope it's supported well. Okay, I'll let it drop, and I'll pick up Wes.
Yeah, John. Just a few things. Nothing really very deep. When I was looking at geophysical methods of looking beneath the ground level and finding what's there using radio waves, which was similar one to the technology that I was utilizing in time of World Trade Center 1 and right before that, which was technology risen as a Korsakoff profiling, being able to see almost everything to the depth of 2 kilometers, although we didn't know what it is. We did use longitudinal wave, but that was mostly vibrational wave, and we were gathering the information from the underground based on ever existing phenomena of vibration. The reason that I brought that is because geophysics as of today is using very low frequency transmitters made for a number of reasons. One of them is for the submarine communication. And one interesting one is the Grimeton. And this one is a kind of historical one. Was raised in Valborg in Sweden, and was operating from 1922 to 1924 at 17.2 kilohertz. So that was the time of Marconi trying to build his power station in California. That frequency was not only one, there was another frequency close to 40 kilohertz that the transmitter was using as well. And it was used for shortwave transmission as well on the frequency of 40 kilohertz. And then he was using 260 meter steel framework mast. What the interesting is that that transmitter was used for transatlantic radio telegraphy to Radio Central in Long Island, New York, and that was the time from 1960 to 1996. And he was transmitting orders to the submarines in the Swedish Navy. Later on, UNESCO found that to be World Cultural Heritage, and they actually preserved that instead of being wasted. Interesting that one would never thought that transatlantic communication would happen at a frequency of 17.2 kilohertz. Tampic 2.
Okay, yeah, at that time period, there was a lot of interesting things going on. I'm not really informed enough to discuss any of that, but there have been a lot of experimentation still going on with huge amount of power to communicate with submarines. And evidently, I know, I believe they can communicate at a depth of 300 feet. This communication is very slow, but from that's my understanding of the communication where it is today. Other than that, I don't have much information on it. If anybody has any comments, please chime in. This is KC2WGB, Landmark TechNet.
Looks like nobody. So then, when I recall Dick talking about the very low frequencies and using the near field and far field. The far field electromagnetic techniques mostly use those existing transmitters, and because that frequency is also penetrating ground to a certain depth, then we have a triangle of reflection. And that is one of the technique trying to find what is beyond the ground. So when the wave goes beyond the ground and then reflect, one could actually calculate the speed in that medium and based on the obstacles, find out at and the speed of transmission, find out what is really disturbing the signal at that particular depth. So that's one of the methods of finding out, seeing in the ground. Although it looks like people always dream, I would love to find out what it is in the ground level. Let me jump. When I was in Elko, Nevada, there was Morari Gold Mine, and I spoke to the people over there, and plenty of them were for 20 years, and they have never seen a gold there, because the gold was in the rock, and it was crushed, then transported to another facility at which the gold was extracted. And we were assisted by from NASA, CDC NASA, Alexander Martins, and also a few guys from United States Geodesic Physical Survey, USGS. And a question was, how can you apply your vibrational technique to find out what's beneath the ground level? Let's say we have a 1 foot thick layer that has the gold in it, and we would like to find out exactly that particle layer. Well, unfortunately, for those who are interested with this subject, most of those techniques don't give you the contents. They give you precise information what is beneath the ground level, what depth it is, how thick it is, all of those variation between the gravel, sand, clay, and other or rocks is being distinct on the cut-off sections, but you don't know what it is. And that was also with the technology that we were utilizing, where we were able to see the layer, but there was a boring needed and take the sample, analyze the sample, and then when they found the gold, we could find out where and how far that layer went. Few words about it is that one of the methods is a seismic method, which is you're using a heavy hammer or the explosive to create vibration, and then based on speed of sound through the medium, you are able to calculate the return path. But mostly you're operating in 2 to 5% of the return energy, so it's very much inefficient. There are other methods like the very low frequency method, and that was pretty nicely used till the Russian transmitters were consequently switched off due to end of the Cold War. So that's the second subject. The third one would be, if we have a time, that would be the airline impedance stabilization network. Back to you.
Okay, well, from your knowledge, have they developed a system that can pattern the topography underground and identify whether it is gold, iron ore, coal, oil, water? Have they been able to do that? KC2WGB, Landmark TechNet.
Yes and no. There is one of the methods, and the method is being called ground penetrating radar. We're dealing with the Earth reach layers that are very close to the vicinity of the surface, based on the topography or the behavior of the waves that are reflect. Usually the radar sends the signal and then it reads back and creates tri-dimensional picture as well. Then yes, you can say by behavior of that wave, how much percentage was absorbed of the signal, how much percentage of it was returned, that this could be an island reach ground. But as far as the deep, I remember that when I was dealing with that was Kennecott Corporation in Salt Lake City, Utah. They were digging for copper, but they were also interesting how deep we could go, and could we see the presence of the oil with it. So we're doing a number of experiments, and we found that unfortunately our methods, or none of the methods known to me, could very precisely describe what it is. Water is one of the things that is very easy to find almost any of the methods, and method is very simple setup. Android GM. The piezoelectric pearl made in USA could be placed on the ground, and the two wires goes to analog digital converter. From that analog digital converter goes to a very simple DOS program. That's what we were utilizing. We've got a patent for it. And then the vibration or that signal was analyzed with Fourier transformation, and it was like you have something that is one, it's something that is solid data, and it was analyzed by components of the frequencies in it. A very simple form to find out. Yes, that would be good to see what is being the ground level. One of the things that Army Rangers in Elko, not Elko, that was Army Rangers in Atlanta, Georgia. Actually, Columbus, Georgia. There was a time of Kosovo, and they required from us to utilize the technology to see the people buried in the basements of the houses that are not existing any longer, or the insurgents there, which was a complete failure for our technology. We could see the cavities over there, but that was the interesting idea at that time that was proposed by me. I create a bomb that doesn't kill anybody, but contains a number of few thousands of the sensors that would actually spread over the ground of the enemy, and then with the spikes goes to the ground and to collect the data to that particular point. And then this information could be uplinked to the balloon or anything that is higher in the altitude, and then from there to the satellite, to then to the command center. But that was an interesting time. Back to you, Antek Jian.
Okay, so from what you're saying, apparently you attempted to try different ways of discovering things, but that didn't work out. But you were able to tell like a mine shaft or cave-ins and things like that, hollow points in the ground. So you could do some acoustical profiling, but no definition, and you couldn't determine exactly what was under the ground. All right. It's interesting history, but I imagine in the past 20 years, that's probably changed a lot by now. KC2 WGB, Limark Technic.
Actually, shorter than that, about the year 2000, we were approved by NASA program, which was extraterrestrial exploration of underground planets and their moons, and I was the principal investigator of the scientific team at that time. There were three companies that were chosen out of close to 300, which was preparation to the device that would be implemented to the Mars Walker or Mars device that would see what is being the ground level of Mars. Unfortunately, the time of September 11 put a very big step on it, and the funds were cut. So although we kind of won that competition, nothing was done at that time, and shortly after that I said to my partners that I'm going out. I couldn't stand what I have seen. The life of the person is so fragile. And now, coming back to the... Oh, I just put a same subject. interesting was for me to find out how sensitive is the Earth. The early communication made by Indians was using the railroad to communicate between them by just knocking to the metal, and it was miles, and they were able to transmit and receive. So then I find out that for someone explained to me a reason when we placed the piece of foil on the ground connected to an analog digital converter, and the device supposed to be a passive one, not the active one, but when I use a tip of my finger just to gently knock the ground about 2 inches of the vicinity of that foil, the amplification of the signal was about 2,000 to 20,000 times. And that actually made me think about the communication using the ground and longitudinal waves. I remember that time we were providing certain experiments, and we were trying to see if we could read the vibration on the greater distance. We end up on approximately 15 meters, which would be 3 times 45 feet distance, and we were able to read the vibration of the finger knocking the ground, and that was a kind of a modulation of the vibration that we were trying to see if it would be distinct and allow just to replace regardless of telephony. But that was never finished. I found later on that Israeli, as I didn't patent that idea, but I went loud with that similar technology could be used, and that was actually in when I was doing a lecture to 200 scientists in the Army headquarters, that actually could be implemented into the box, and those box could be thrown out from the jeep around the demilitarized zones of around the Kosovo, and each one of them could contain a very small transmitter operated not on the battery but based on the vibration of piezoelectric to send the signal. At that point it will prevent the insurgents or anybody just going into the area that is forbidden for them to pass, and also a solution for the Mexico and United States border. And then I find out a few years later that the Israelis were trying to implement the same technology. I know that actually came to them, but yeah, they did that, and right now it looks like this technology slowly is being developed in the border. They're also good around the prison, because it is also almost impossible for somebody to sneak in, and these devices don't need any batteries. So that's about that, and then we can switch to line impedance stabilization network. Back to you.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I've noticed that in very high secure areas where I work, there was what looked like a small coax wire that they would bury in the ground, and it would do exactly what you're saying. I don't know if that was piezoelectric or whether it was something else, but that's been used for quite a few years, and the military is where it came from. So that wouldn't surprise me at all. I've seen the installations and I've seen them work, and they could pick up a duck walking a block away. It was amazing. Okay, Wes, I don't know what this other subject you're talking about is, but go ahead. We got a few yet. KC2WGB, Limark TechNet.
Yeah, interesting. Well, just your comments. See, I was always kind of in opposition to the patents and patent applications, and I hate that. I remember when we were doing a patent with Mr. Fitzpatrick, that was our professional in this area. Beautiful mind and very, very honest person, retired already. He said, well, guys, I wish you the best, but the law doesn't work this way. And some of the things that you have might be absolutely beautiful, but then will you get a patent on it? Or will you be able to make money on it? Something simply doesn't pay to patent. Considering the fact that just a patent for a paper clip is about $10,000. In 2007, I went with the idea and I was free already from my activity in the company. I created the ultimate weapon. And if you can remember, one of the materials that I have sent you was a sniper gun. So the gun could be anywhere, and the target could be anywhere. And the sniper could be anywhere. Now we have a triangle. So I was kind of playing with that. From the calculation, it looks like the accuracy was 150 feet, the center of the quarter. And then I went to Mr. Fitzpatrick, and I told him about it, and he says, listen, at first, I found, yes, you have a chance to patent, but when you set the application for 3 years, nobody's going to look at it apart from few people. And then you might receive a different color paper, which will think that you are in a state of secrecy. And that might never be used by the army because it's already being assigned after you file the application to that group. So then, the next thing after 3 years passed by is that you may receive a paper standing about 12 years. This thing is going to be on the shelf and have no right to talk about it. And then after that, even more. So he said, how old you are, Wesley? So I gave up. And it's good because I don't believe minds of the people should be employed in the area of killing. The Line Appearance Stabilization Network is a device that is used to measure conduct to radio frequency emission that is pure in nature. John, you said that you had a use, at least I recall that, of those line impedance stabilization network, which was the PAX, in the certain areas. I wonder if you could say what areas that was used for. And to
KC2, Delta 2WGV, yes, it was used on 3 jobs, as I remember, but it was for measurements. It had to do with the EMI. It was only used to sort of as a filter so that they made sure that it was set at 60 cycles and that no other frequency was going to come in and disturb the equipment that it was monitoring. That's where it was used in my experience. Other uses, I don't know. I wouldn't know what to do with one other than what I saw it done. And that was on a very, very technical job with a lot of money at stake. And it did work. And they were able to find locations for these transmissions of spurious signals, and they were able to solve the issues.
some of it was, I believe, common rejection problems and exocase radiation, which they didn't think could happen. They thought it was very well shielded, this equipment, but there were areas where it was emitting spurious signals which were interfering with another device. So, and that was on a military job. So other than that, I don't know much about that use. Back to you, Wes.
From what I know about it is that they use it when they want, this thing provides a very characteristic impedance of the power source, and it's provided to the device on the test across specified frequency range. So let's say the requirement is that 9 kilohertz to 30 megahertz is the frequency that should be immune from any kind of influence. Remember when last week I spoke to Dick, and I, although we didn't have much time, and I said, hey, we have 50 ohms, which is a standard of 75 ohm for cable TV. That is the output or the input of the device. But at the same time, we have never touched the subject of what is the impedance of the power line. And then there was a whole discussion standing that that is something that we don't really very much are able to measure, because it varies. It's nothing that is a standard. So one of the things that when I'm working on the devices that will actually save the energy, or say use the energy that is free of pay, something that I call free energy or untapped energy, is simply the energy that comes from somewhere but is just not being taxed or not being paid for. Let me drop. I really did say a few words standing about the power company would be very much unhappy if the impedance, or say resistance, at their end will be high. It has to be milli ohms in their point, but it has to be high at your point, because then we have the voltage time current that would create the power. So then with the ohms law, the resistance of the device, the smaller it is, the less the energy it uses. So, question for you, John. What would that be if, let's say, you are able at your place to create the reverse situation? The resistance and the impedance at your place is low, compatible with the one of the power station. But two.
Well, I wouldn't be able to go below where the power station is. I wouldn't even be able to get close to it, because things would start to melt. I have no experience in that, even attempting it, but I think that would be ludicrous to even think you could get anywhere near it. The amount of current you'd be drawing, the amount of power you'd be using, be prohibitive.
I understand that. Well, the people have something that is being called a Joule CF. So various number of techniques just to try to fool around with the meters, but that's not my area of expertise, and that's not something that I want to talk about. But since the line impedance stabilization network is the one that uses a lower pass filter, which would be a P filter, the one that we use in our amplifiers for ham radio communication, that would be the filter that is perfectly good for the frequency up to 50-60 hertz, and welcome, you can pass, but everything above that is very much restricted. That also restricting all of the communication that is being carrying on the power lines. As the person who was pretty much close to the electrical field, do you know which one, which communication I'm talking about? Thank you.
Well, if you're talking about broadband over power lines, there's also another thing. For the demand meters, Edison puts out a pulse every so many minutes to trip demand indicators on the demand type meters. I don't know if you've ever seen them. That you can tell them they have a key in the front. So they have been using pulses on the AC feeds to industry and homes for many years. So, but your impedance stabilization network, I don't know how that would affect. Like I said, no experience with it, so I really have no idea.
Well, what kind of communication? What would be the broadband communication or the pole control poles or the spying agencies or anything like that? Or the X10 devices, the home automation devices? It is operating on the frequency that is more than 50 hertz. So we have a pulse width modulation, or we have any kind of modulation that could be implemented into the power lines, and most of the people had no idea that that exists there. Now, we need to implement the line impedance stabilization network. None of those signals, including the ones that you mentioned, would be able to pass or eventually to come through. There would be no triggering of anything. And just here.
Well, there would be, because your application of whatever device has to be post-metering. So the meter would still see the window of the pulse for the demand meter. There's no way to put that instrumentation that you're talking about before the meter. That won't be acceptable.
Oh, I see that. I see that. I understand that. So by putting any kind of filter, not the device by itself, because line impedance stabilization network is nothing more, nothing less, but it's filter that is made from one capacitor, 8 microfarad, one resistor, 5 ohm, the second capacitor, 250 nanofarad, and another resistor, which is 1 kilo ohm. And basically, it's a P filter. So you have input and one end of the coil. Then on the same leg, you have a capacitor and the resistor in series. Now you have the ground wire. So we have two wires. Then we have a coil, and then we, from the other side, from the opposite side, we have exactly the same. A capacitor and a resistor and two outputs. And you see it.
Well, the makeup of the device, it can be done several ways with many different values for components. But what is the point? Do you have a question? Is there something in that information?
No, I'm trying to see the theoretical or unreal scenario in which that impulse is being blocked. What would then happen?
Well, if you could choke out the demand window pulse before the meter, I believe that's possible, and the meter would not recognize demand commands. So that wouldn't make the power company happy, that's for sure. But I really don't see any other use for the device in any of my applications anywhere. I don't know where you're going with that. But you know what I think I should do? I think I should close the net now without Dick here. It would seem that we have covered everything with most of the people. And we'll pick it up again after I close the net, and we'll carry on and return it to amateur use. Let me kick it back to you just a quick question. KC2WGB.
You're right. Thank you. you very much, everybody, for listening to the TechNet. And thank you, John, for playing it beautifully for all of us. And have a good night. This is NJCN.
Okay, this is KC2WGB, Landmark TechNet. We will close the net at this time, and we will pick it up again next Sunday. I want to thank everybody for their participation. We've got a lot of great information and a lot of good opinions and some great recommendations. And I just hope there was enough people listening that are going to benefit from this. I'm sure there are some. We do have a pretty fair-sized audience out there. So I want to thank you all again and return next week. This is KC2WGB, closing the Landmark TechNet, approximately 11:05. And we'll talk to you again. KC2WGB, clear.
Good night, John. WS2N 73.
73, Paul. Thank you for your efforts. Great information tonight. I hope we have more next week. You be well. Stay safe. KC2WGB.
Okay, yeah, there's always always something new in the space race. Have a good night. WS2N, we'll be clear.
Yeah, Paul, I just lost because I had a phone call. The part when you said that Mars is a one big diamond. If you could give a few words about it.
That's not what he said.
Okay, John.
What did I say, John? I missed what Wesley said. Something about Mars.
Yeah, Wesley seemed to think that you said Mars. He confused that with the other statement because he was on the phone, was made of diamond. Maybe you want to explain that issue.
Oh, okay. No, that was a planet that they discovered. I think it was 129 million light years from here, something like that. That they believe is all carbon. I mean, solid carbon. Couple of, maybe the size of Jupiter or something, but it compressed down, you know. Just they figure the whole place has got. You can go there, you wouldn't know what to do with all these diamonds. That's what I was talking about, Wesley. Okay. No, Mars. Yeah, Mars is just a rocky terrestrial place, just like Earth, with very poor magnetic sphere. They do have a magnetic sphere. If you look it up on a map that they drew, it does have little magnetic areas all over the planet, but nothing like we have. But no diamonds. Who knows? There might be a diamond or two at the bottom of, you know, maybe in the middle of Mars somewhere. But back to you, Wesley.
I guess De Beers has nothing to worry about yet.
I just wonder if the Beers will be likely to go for it or would be likely to try to block it. John?
Yeah, well, they have a history of doing that. They did the same thing with the Russians, so there's something to contend with, that's for sure. So let me ask you, Wes, what is your plan with this Deaton stabilizer? What do you need it for?
I don't need it for anything. It's just for me to have another piece of information, to know how it works and what I can do with it. Eventually, if I have something that I want